Religious liberty is in crisis like never before, and the biggest threat to our freedom? Our own government. Hi, I'm Stuart Shepard, and this is First Liberty Live. We are at the NRB Christian Media Convention here in the exhibit hall. Hasn't opened up yet, so we crashed the place and broke on in here. Talking to this guy, you may recognize Ken Starr.
Hi, Ken. Hi there, Stuart.
I'm going to read his resume in a minute, but first I want to show you his book. It's called Religious Liberty in Crisis. I want to make sure I get the title right. It is an awesome book. It's a worthwhile read. And if you've got some summer reading lists that you're working on for you and your family, highly recommend this. So excellent book. Thank you for writing it. I'm going to hand this off to my son, who's reading it right now.
Thank you, Andrew.
Our guest has argued 36 cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, including during his service as Solicitor General of the United States. He served as president of Baylor University, go Bears. He's dean of the Pepperdine Law School, and he's a best-selling author, among other things. And he's been a champion of religious freedom his entire career. Ken Starr, welcome again to First Liberty Live.
Thank you, Stuart. So good to be back with you.
We had a great conversation recently, and I wanted to pick up where we left off talking to you. But some news has happened in between, and I want to get your take on it. A case out of Philadelphia involving foster care and faith. Tell me your reaction to the Supreme Court ruling in the Fulton case.
I was delighted, relieved. I was pleasantly surprised that it was unanimous. It was narrowly unanimous, but a unanimous opinion in favor of religious liberty is an enormous win to be celebrated. And I'm sure we'll talk about some of the concurring opinions. The court could have gone farther, but I think that the opinion that Chief Justice Roberts authored for all nine members of the court is such a stunning victory, because the cultural elite, including, I'm a lawyer, I'm a member of the American Bar Association, the ABA was on the other side. And I think people need to be reminded, the district judge ruled the other way, ruled in favor of Philadelphia. The three Court of Appeals judges ruled unanimously in favor of Philadelphia. This is an enormous victory, so we should celebrate it.
As soon as we heard it was 9-0, we knew it was going to be a narrow ruling, meaning they're going to limit the scope of it to where it can't impact too far outside of specifically what it deals with. But the larger issues you're talking about have to do with a precedent-setting decision from about 30 years ago, I think. You're talking about the Smith decision.
Yes, the Smith decision, which said, seemingly harmlessly, but it wasn't, that if a state or if Congress passes a law, and these are the key concepts, it applies generally, and it's neutral toward religion, that is, it's not aimed or targeted at religion, then it's okay, and judges are not to create, through interpreting the Free Exercise Clause, exceptions for conscientious objectors. Oh, what a terrible decision. And happily, Stuart, as you know, Congress responded, and President Clinton signed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act into law.
With an overwhelming majority of Congress.
An overwhelming majority. Now, what the Congress thought it was doing was wiping the slate clean of the Smith decision, but it exceeded its powers. Good motives, but it went too far. And so the Supreme Court then later held, Congress, you've done a lot of damage here to our federal system. You can't tell the states and localities what to do. So a number of states are enacting what are called mini RFRAs, small versions, state versions of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. But in the meantime, we've had the March of Secularism. There are some states where the idea of a mini RFRA, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, would simply be dead on arrival. So it's important eventually for the Supreme Court of the United States to overrule this decision, undo the damage that does continue.
And we have a case still making its way up through the courts involving a coach in Washington who said a silent prayer on the 50-yard line and got fired over it. And it also, in the larger arc of things, will be a challenge to that Smith decision. We're hoping to flip it then.
Yes, absolutely. The coach, Kennedy, it is such a powerful case, but he is a coach in a sea of hostility toward religious freedom and religious exercise. Ironically, the facts in that case are so cruel. He wasn't coercing anyone. He wasn't even trying to influence anyone. So this is not someone using his or her power position to coerce players or others to involve themselves in religious activity, prayer or otherwise. But here the courts of Washington state, this is a harbinger of things to come, just said no. he loses. So the hostility toward religious faith, so I want to praise First Liberty for standing firm with him, continuing to litigate that case. And that may be the case that results in the overruling of Employment Division versus Smith, a pox on its house. We love Justice Scalia and honor his memory, but he made a big mistake on that one.
Thank you for the kind words. Hey, you once stood in front of the nine justices at the Supreme Court and asked them in so many words to overturn Roe v. Wade, the decision that legalized abortion. In your book, you go on to explain a legal idea, a legal concept. In Latin, it's stare decisis. My Latin is not very good, but I believe it means let it stand, essentially. And how that particular approach by the court has impacted religious freedom. What does stare decisis mean, really, and what should people know about how the two are connected, Roe and that particular legal concept?
Yeah, and what it means is, hey, we decided this, so call the next case because we're not going to go revisit a decision that we've already made. So I did have the privilege of arguing when I was serving as Solicitor General under President Bush 41, Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided and should be overruled. But the Supreme Court said, well, no, we're not going to do that. We cut back on Roe v. Wade. That was helpful, allowing greater flexibility for the states in regulating, but they wouldn't go that far. Now, I think the Supreme Court of the United States certainly has another opportunity. We will see, is the Fulton case a harbinger of things to come, upholding, hopefully, the Mississippi law on abortion, cutting off the deadline, so to speak, at 15 weeks. So again, allowing greater flexibility, we hope and pray for that. But now here's the point. This idea of stare decisis is important to apply when the court is interpreting a statute passed by Congress. We need stability in the law, but not when it's interpreting the Constitution of the United States. And what Planned Parenthood versus Casey did in saying this principle of stare decisis is so important in constitutional law was itself, ironically, a departure from precedent. We want to follow precedent, but that's not been your precedent. And my favorite example, Stuart, is the compulsory flag salute case. The flag salute case,
the Barnett sisters, I believe.
Thank you. Decided in 1943, overruled a contrary, obviously, decision by the Supreme Court only 3 years previously. And they didn't act like Hamlets in the Supreme Court, oh, to overrule or not to overrule, oh me, oh my. They just overruled it. Why? Because the prior decision
was wrong,
period. What is it about wrong you don't understand? And Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. So I'm sorry that the justices have put themselves into this sort of Hamlet-like anguish. Can we, should we, and so forth. My view is, easy for me to say, I'm not there, but I think it is the correct view. You have a duty to decide cases in accordance with your vision of the Constitution. That's why you're there.
I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here, but you really opened my eyes to something I never really thought about before in this discussion, and you mentioned it in passing there a moment ago, and that is if Congress passes a law and the Supreme Court says not good, then Congress can pass another law to fix that. If the executive branch issues an executive order and the Supreme Court says not so fast, the executive order can try again and issue another one. But if the Supreme Court makes a ruling on the Constitution, an interpretation, and in Roe they basically envisioned and imagined this right to privacy that all of it was built on, they came up with that out of whole cloth, out of nothing. There's no place to go to fix that.
You can't go to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. They'll say, what are you doing here? You have to go back to the Supreme Court of the United States and ask them to fix their mistake. And that's what's happening in the Roe v. Wade context, and I think it will happen in the religious freedom context.
Very helpful. Let's talk a little more about the dynamics in play. We have a case involving a football coach. We talked about Joe Kennedy just a second ago and his 15-second silent prayer. Four of the justices at the court noted in turning it away the first time that they noticed that we didn't mention that we brought it as a free speech case, not as a religious freedom case. And they wrote in there that, well, that may be because of this Smith decision that we had some years ago. And I know that was a long setup for a question, but walk us through the connection between Kennedy and Smith and how this may finally be the end of that. We talked about it a little bit. I want you to just put the final note on that.
Yes. When someone prays, one is engaging in an act of free speech. So there are different rights that are being implicated by that one specific action. So one is exercising, as I should say, Justice Kennedy. It's Coach Kennedy. It's Coach Kennedy.
Maybe he'll be Justice Kennedy someday.
Yeah, there it is. Go to law school. Awesome. It's never too late. Yeah. So he was exercising, we would think more naturally, his faith by praying. But the Supreme Court has been very clear. Worship is a form of freedom of speech. So it's both, right? It also implicates freedom of association when you worship with a community. So it just adds to the power, to the strength. But what prayer is, of course, is a quintessentially act of faith. It's a religious act and should rightly be viewed by the court as a free exercise case. Now, you're great lawyers at First Liberty, so you said, okay, we've got the Smith roadblock.
We want to win.
So we want to win, so let's just go through the freedom of speech route. The Supreme Court let it stand for now. But it is very naturally, as you rightly are suggesting, it's a free exercise case. And that's why, again, we may see the Smith case. Hey, this interpretation by the Washington State Supreme Court of the authority of state and local governments just goes too far. It trenches upon the rights of believers, non-believers as well, but of course it really hurts believers to prevent them from living out their faith. So that may be the route that the court decides to take in its discretion.
So if, and we'll speak hypothetically here, if Smith should be overturned, how would that change how we can do the work we do in protecting religious freedom? What would that mean going forward as far as how cases are brought before the court?
It means it changes the world, because it means that when the government intrudes into the free exercise of religion, the government has to come up with a compelling interest in doing so, and then it has to show that what it did is being done by the narrowest means possible.
And those are legal terms of art. Unpack those a bit, what those mean.
It just means the state have a really big, important reason the heavens are falling if we don't step in. And they lose. They're going to lose in terms of a coach of his own free will engaging in a 15-second moment of silent prayer. It's not even close. It would be laughable for them to say, we are so secularist here in the state of Washington that we're going to do everything we can to stop religious exercise on public grounds by public officials. That shows what? Hostility to religion, which is completely forbidden by the free exercise clause.
Very helpful. In your book, you warn about something called the harm principle. And just explain to us what you mean by that and what we should be alert to in this current cancel culture.
This is the idea that your exercise of freedom is harming me. It may not be sticks and stones breaking my bones, but you've harmed my sense of humanity, my sense of human dignity. And that really is at issue in a number of cases, but most familiarly to the audience would be Jack Phillips of Masterpiece.
I shook his hand yesterday. He makes a mean brownie.
Did you get a brownie from Jack?
Oh. He sent one down once. I got to eat it. I always tell people that, but he's a gracious fellow.
He's a wonderful person who could not in conscience bake or design. He can bake a cake, but he can't design a cake in conscience to celebrate an activity, their same-sex marriage. But it could be Halloween or it could be a divorce. He just can't do that in conscience.
And he did turn down cakes like you just mentioned.
Yeah, he wouldn't do a Halloween cake. Now, he serves Halloween. You can come in with your trick-or-treat costume and he'll sell you a brownie, right?
Yeah.
Or he'll bake you a cake, but he's just not going to celebrate Halloween as an event. Now, people can say, well, that's a little bit odd, a little eccentric, but this is who we are in this country. We protect people's conscience, and we don't force them to do things that they cannot in conscience do. In the main, I mean, there are exceptions to that, race discrimination being an obvious one. So what's happening is those who want to be served in the sense of especially cake being designed, you're saying you're declining to do that, Mr. Phillips, is injuring me. You're harming me. You're harming my sense of human dignity, my sense of inclusion.
And the irony here is we have a case with Aaron and Melissa Klein from the West Coast. Similar case. They were asked to bake a custom cake for a same-sex ceremony. They politely declined. And they were bankrupted by the state. They were put out of business. And they're still fighting that in court. But they were levied a fine of $135,000. You want to talk about harm? That's harmful.
Yeah, oh, it's cruel. This is the mean-spiritedness of the state and, frankly, of the plaintiffs who, instead of just saying, okay, it's not as if I can't get a cake somewhere, I'm going to punish these people for their views. So it's a rigid intolerance and a mean-spiritedness. I'm just going to go ahead and say that. I know we're not supposed to judge that should be not judged. But what else explains it? It's not as if they can't get a specialty cake from someone else. We're just going to put you, and putting you out of business, a draconian fine. What is the point? The point can only be runaway secularism.
Okay, so you got our attention. We want to do something to stop the madness. What are three things we can do?
Well, one of the things I suggest is let's get control over the levers of power. Let's not sit idly by and allow school boards to carry on and city councils to carry on. The City of Philadelphia case that we were talking about earlier was the result of the city council. Those people are elected. They're not anointed. They're not appointed by the king. So let's get busy and get good people elected. In the book, I said, please consider running. You know, there's an example, as you know, Stuart, the Lieutenant Governor of North Carolina just came onto the political stage because he stood up as an African American complaining about what was happening in his own community in a city council meeting. It went viral. Everybody says, he is so talented. And he wasn't in politics at all. He was a citizen who stood up and had the courage of his convictions. Well, if someone says, well, I'm like Moses. I need an Aaron to do the talking for me. I can't run for office, but I'll bet you can identify someone who you can encourage, your church group, your community group, can say, you know, we really need people of faith going into these positions. That is number one. Number two is to, I hope, to understand the principles of liberty more fully so we don't just rail against these powers and these terrible things that are happening, but we're able to discuss them intelligently and to say, by the way, the view I'm espousing is the view of a unanimous Supreme Court. So please don't think that this is just the conservatives on the court. No, this is the Supreme Court of the United States. When we last spoke, I love the example, unanimous Supreme Court, of the court that included Ruth Bader Ginsburg at that time, upholding the right of a Christian school to fire one of its teachers who had a really colorable claim under. People don't know about that. Pastors need to know about that. Deacons and Sunday school teachers, but grandparents need to know it. So they can say to their children, you know, when you go off to school, go off to college, or you're back from college and so forth, please know that the culture of liberty is what we stand for in this country. And there are all these anti-liberty forces. What we've been talking about with Jack Phillips, oh, well, you're intruding into the liberty of the couple that wanted a cake. No, you're not. You're not at all. They can get the cake elsewhere and in the City of Philadelphia. There are some 20 groups that would place these precious children with same-sex couples. They didn't need to go to Catholic Social Services, and no one had. It was sort of the cruelty of, we're going to wipe you out. That was the meanness of spirit that I'm talking about. So that's point two. And then point three is, I'm just going to say it, please support First Liberty. Please support Alliance Defending Freedom. This is not the church of your choice. This is, we got to fight for freedom. So there are more than one group. First Liberty is just right there at the vanguard of it. We need to support so that we can expand the services. When I say we, I'm putting myself in the family, so that these Friends of Freedom have the resources they need to go into court, because when we go into court, we may lose at the district court, we may lose at the Court of Appeals, but when we get into the Supreme Court, liberty wins, every single time. That's a great hope.
Very good. Ken Starr, thank you so much for making time for us. It's always a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you, Stuart.
And thank you for watching. Hey, if this resonates with you, if religious freedom is something you care about, would you consider partnering with us at First Liberty Institute, as you were just mentioning? Just go to firstlibertylive.com, look for the big red donate button at the top. And also, if you would, please, like and share our videos so that your friends can also see. If you're interested in this, your friends and family likely are too, and that's how we get to meet new people. We will see you next time right here on First Liberty Live.